With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City News Day. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us this morning for your agriculture news. Today is Tuesday, October 17th. Coming up in today's show, developing another early detection method for HLB. We'll have more on that in a little bit, but first, here's Taylor Hillman.
California Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross brought some hope to growers at Citrus Research Board's annual conference last week. Ross used the battle against Pierce's disease that the grape industry faced 10 to 15 years ago as an example of agriculture overcoming a disease and insect.
And there's a lot to learn. I forgot to mention that just next week, the Executive Committee of the Citrus Committee and the Pierce's Disease Board are going to meet to just share lessons learned, some of the strategies, because there's some of the research that's happened in Pierce's disease has application for this and vice versa, how we work with our nursery partners. So there's a lot for us to learn from each other.
Ross admitted that Huanglongbing disease is scary with what it's done to Florida, but added that this is the time to adjust our response to make sure the industry is all focused on the same goals.
But it's so frightening at the time to be in the heat of that battle. And so that's why this is a really good time and a crossroads to do a strategic plan, because we've got to be in this for the long haul and make sure we're putting the resources around the right priorities. It's about keeping the pest, could vector the disease, away from our commercial production and to rapidly work on long-time cures. One of the things we learned in Pierce's disease was that we were leaving the reservoir of the bacterium there. So that's why the early detection tools are so critically important. If in fact we identify a tree that has the bacterium in it, we need to be able to, with assurances, because that's a big investment, to pull out that tree as quickly as possible.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
There were not many big changes in the global cotton market, although declines were registered in the United States. Here's Stephanie Ho with more.
World Ag Outlook Board Chair Seth Meyer says changes in cotton on the global level are pretty small.
Most of the action that we'll talk about here in the cotton market is in the U.S. They trimmed harvested area and yield, incorporating effects in both Texas and in Georgia. In Georgia in particular, we're looking at hurricane effects.
For the specific losses,
about a 11% reduction in Georgia production. Overall, you got a 640,000 bale decline in U.S. cotton production. Mill use also, though, down on increased Southern Hemisphere competition.
So what does this mean for U.S. cotton overall?
Some of that reduction will take away from our export program, but also take a little bit of it out of stocks. So stocks down 200,000 bales.
He says there is no change in the estimated price of cotton at 60 cents per pound at the midpoint. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Growth in the Southeast Asia market provides an opportunity to expand U.S. exports. Through work by the U.S. Grains Council, nations in the region are buying more U.S. grain byproducts. Manuel Sanchez serves as the Grain Council's regional director for South and Southeast Asia and is based in a USGC office in the region. Sanchez says the Southeast Asia market is large and growing, providing opportunities for U.S. agricultural products.
It's one of the most populous corner of the world with over 2.2 billion people if you combine India into the mix. It's a market that's going to need U.S. agricultural products. It's a market that's going to rely on U.S. ag as one of the primary sources for their grain needs. It's also a market that's growing. It's fast growing. If you look at per capita poultry consumption, it's a market that still has a lot to grow compared to more of the mature markets. At least stay abreast and stay on top of what's going on in this region from a U.S. farmer perspective. Because although we might not be shipping a lot of U.S. corn per se, we're shipping a lot of co-products and ethanol. Those are the high-value products that we want to see going into this region.
He says India's dairy industry represents a potential market for U.S. dried distillers grain with solubles.
USDDGs in particular have not made it into India yet because of policy restrictions that are imposed into DDGs, but we're working hard with their local dairy industry to persuade and push their government to allow the imports of DDGS. India has one of the largest dairy herds in the world, so if we're able to gain access to that market, ultimately we gain access to one of the biggest dairy producers in the world.
Beyond that, he says more buyers within the region are turning to DDGs from the United States.
You got a market like Cambodia. Traditionally, they haven't really been big DDGS buyers. And in the past 6 months, they've bought over 30,000 metric tons. Bangladesh is in there. We've seen a large increase out of Malaysia. you know, you, markets that don't necessarily come to mind when you think of Southeast Asia is within our own region is Pakistan. Pakistan is buying DDGS and the Philippines as well. So these are all markets that we cover within our Southeast Asia region. It's a big territory with a lot of demand and a lot of work to still be done. There's still opportunity. There's still, you know, markets that we could capture.
U.S. Ethanol is also finding new markets within the region.
There's two primary markets within my jurisdiction that consume U.S. ethanol, India being the largest one. U.S. ethanol is currently flowing into India primarily for the industrial purposes, not necessarily as a fuel. And then the Philippines is a market where U.S. ethanol is also flowing into.
He says work by the U.S. Grains Council helps improve market access to those markets. For example, the Grains Council worked to remove the suspension of U.S. DDGs issued by Vietnam in December of last year.
When the government suspended the imports primarily because of a phytosanitary issue, you know, we lost that market. The U.S. Grains Council turned into action and we allocated the resources needed to have people on the ground and work with the local government there to open up the market. Primarily with these type of suspensions, you normally see a one-year period where it normally takes for the government to lift them and get all the answers that they need. But we were able to turn that around and in 6 months open the market back up.
Learn more about the U.S. Grains Council online at www.grains.org. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. I am your host, Sabrina Hill. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
When it comes to a healthy bottom line for your farming operation, nothing helps like healthy soil. Producers who use soil health management systems report lower input costs while maintaining or even improving their yields. Plus, those systems help with drought protection and soil and water conservation. Contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office today to find out more and unlock the secrets in your soil. This message brought to you by the NRCS and this radio station.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our technical skills,
our math, our engineering skills.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our organizational skills, our problem-solving skills.
You're going to need our determination, our honesty, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise, we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
AgNet West Radio Network.
The House Budget Committee has voted 22-14 along party lines.
Your trusted agriculture news provider for the state of California. AgNet West's team of Sabrina Hill.
As crews continue to fight the Detweiler fire in Mariposa County.
Brian German.
Weedy rice has been a growing concern for California farmers.
And myself, Taylor Hillman. Join us every day to stay up to date with the latest agriculture news from AgNet West Radio Network and online at agnetwest.com.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take with you from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers, but these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Feltz.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and that the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the silage zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. Here's Brian German.
Researchers are making progress in the development of another early detection tool for Huanglongbing disease. Yoan Laveau is a professor of plant pathology at UC Davis. He's been studying microbial communities in citrus and the pathogen associated with HLB, known as CLAS. By identifying the microbial differences, there's potential for detecting an infected tree earlier than some of the current methods.
We've demonstrated that at least it's true for the situation with CLAS-infected trees. CLAS-infected trees tend to, under greenhouse conditions and also some field conditions that we saw, they have different microbial community compositions on their leaf surfaces than uninfected trees. And we don't know exactly what the mechanism is of that. So in other words, we don't know what connection there is between the CLAS infection and the microbial community composition change. But what we do know is that that could actually be used to come up with a better way to predict whether or not a particular tree is infected with CLAS.
I'm Brian German for Ragnet West Radio Network.
Could small declines in U.S. rice production and already low stocks begin to impact prices? Stephanie Ho reports.
World Ag Outlook Board Chair Seth Meyer says changes in U.S. rice production are small.
A reduction in Texas, I believe, or a change in Texas, 4,000-acre change in Texas, so pretty modest. A change in yield that's also quite small in terms of absolute size, I think 0.5% on yields.
But he adds this decline comes at a time when the rice stocks are already low.
While that decline in stocks of about 1.1 million hundredweight is not large, we're already making a pretty significant year-over-year tightening of those. Of the rice market, so we're hitting a stock level that's the lowest in about 14 years.
Which he adds could put pressure on rice prices.
So when we look at our midpoint price of $13.20, that is above what we're seeing at spot prices today. So our expectation is that we'd see prices actually moving a little bit higher for the rest of the year than what we're observing right prior to the report.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Well, in today's livestock news, the Public Lands Council and National Cattlemen's Beef Association recently reacted to the Department of Interior's announcement that it will open a public comment period and assess options for amending the flawed 2015 plan amendments for conservation of the greater sage-grouse in 11 western states. The group said that the action opens a door to potentially provide much-needed relief to ranchers across the West. Last month, NCBA and PLC's Executive Director Ethan Lane had these comments about the Interior's review of the sage-grouse plans.
So Interior embarked on a review of those sage-grouse resource management plans from 2015. In this case, the Secretary ordered a review top to bottom of the way these plans have gone into effect. He brought the state directors from across the West into that process to make sure that the local cattlemen's groups in those states were working directly with their state BLM directors to determine how those impacts were playing out at the local level. Again, that's a theme we keep coming back to because that's what's been missing from so much of this in the past. That review was published a few weeks ago. We've gone through it with a fine-tooth comb. Our sage-grouse leadership in the industry has been reviewing that and looking for our path forward. We've seen a lot of our own guidance come out in that review, so we were happy to see that they're listening to cattle producers and they're listening to our concerns with those plans. Public Lands Council was the only national organization that was mentioned in that document as a group that Interior needs to make sure they incorporate and work with moving forward. That speaks volumes about the work that our state affiliates and the national level has done on this issue, that Interior understands how important we are to this process. The conversation now comes down to how do you fix the resource management plans so they don't inappropriately target grazing. Grazing is not a listed threat to the sage grouse. It's not even in the top 10. And the problem is, despite that, we've been targeted by the implementation of these RMPs because we're so easy to target, because you have 22,000 permittees spread out across the West, a lot of whom have to go back to the BLM and the Forest Service to get permit renewals. And when they do, this issue keeps coming up. So we're working with Interior and building on this review. And the review wasn't really an end of a conversation. It was the beginning. What it was 13 pages and another 35 of supporting documentation from Interior, basically saying, hey, we get it. We hear that there are problems. Here's our take on what those problems are. And now the ball is back in our court as an industry, along with some of the other impacted industries, to tell them, yes, we think you're on the right track, or no, you missed it here. And here's where we think you need to go from here to get this thing done. So that's the process we're in now.
Again, that was Ethan Lane with NCBA and Public Lands Council. Lane said, I want to thank the Interior Department for their willingness to work with the states and ranchers to get these plans right. Now, the public may submit comments to the proposed changes through a 45-day comment period that ends in November. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
Consumers do get tired of paying high prices for food. A long-range study by a Southwestern university showed how the retail prices of meat caused families to change the dinner menu. Some of the changes may surprise you. The demand for ham topped the list. Retail sales fell over 15% during the time of that study. Price was the reason. Folks got tired of paying high prices for hamburger meat. Consumption slipped almost 8%. Now, these meats had to be replaced with something. Yeah, pork chop purchases were up 10%. Chicken breasts showed more retail sales. The study covered 1,000 families. By the way, it showed more families are eating at home, too. And the reason is price. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, AgNet West.
Our Taylor Hillman is at the California Association of Pest Control Advisors annual meeting. It's happening this week in Reno, Nevada. There, he spoke with the California Farm Bureau President, Paul Winger. Here's the interview.
Paul Winger, President, California Farm Bureau.
You just got done speaking at CAPCA. The first thing you started out with up there was, you know, everyone might be start using the same technology and all that kind of data and all that kind of stuff, but the one thing we always have here in California is the climate. Mm-hmm. And people always ask you, maybe we shouldn't be farming the desert. And what's your comments on that?
Well, my comment is, where are you going to farm? I mean, you know, our Midwest is so, so important. All across this country is so very important. But where irrigation isn't there and you can turn on a valve and put water on the amount that you need when you need it, then we're really susceptible to whatever the weather is. And I've talked to a lot of my counterparts in the Midwest within the same state. I mean, somebody is getting in the middle of a drought, somebody else is getting flooded out, and somebody else having a good year. We don't necessarily have that problem here in California as long as we have the water that we can turn on. That means stored water or groundwater.
You talked about water up there, too. I think a lot of people don't understand how beneficial the WIN Act was in some of the water that we're seeing now, right?
Yeah, the WIN Act allowed a change to the biological opinions on the Delta smelt, which has been the real issue of being able to send water south. We have the pumps, and we've heard about the governor wanting to do his Delta fix, the two Delta tunnels, and that's got a lot of consternation and huge cost. Agriculture probably couldn't even afford the water once it's there. We've got the infrastructure. It's just that an environmental lawsuit over the Delta smelt prevented the pumps being used. The WIN Act made it to where you actually have to use science to see if the smelt are being harmed. If they're not, we're pumping the water. And that's what happened, and we have San Luis Reservoir that is full today because of it.
You talked about the difference between competitors and enemies, really kind of joining the industry together. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, so much of us in agriculture, whether we're here at CAPCA and we have PCAs or farmers in general, we see each other as competition. But we've got to get past that, and we've got to work together. We're such a minority in the world today, and the world is so dependent upon us. We need to work together, and we're not each other's enemy. The enemy is really those who, I call them elitists. Those that aren't worrying about where their next meal is going to come from, those who can afford designer-produced foods. But we're producing for a growing population, 9 billion people in the near future worldwide, and a lot of those areas can't feed themselves. We can feed them if we're allowed to do so with the technologies that we have that are proven to be environmentally safe, safe for consumers. We just need to be able to fight that battle, and we're such a minority of the population today, we've got to work together, and again, we're each other's ally, not our enemy.
Yeah. Your message at a lot of these talks, and it was again today, was you gotta take action. We need to be doing something as an industry. You talked about some examples where growers were like, oh, we'll stay here, that's Farm Bureau does that, and then the other side shows up, and we get outranked, basically.
That's what happens, unfortunately. A lot of folks just say, well, our organizations are going to do it. Our organizations are there to monitor and keep a pulse of what's going on. And then when they call out and say, now you need to show up, show up. We're not going to cry wolf. We're not going to have you come to every meeting. But unfortunately, there's a lot of folks for these other NGOs, environmental groups. They're just there. They pay them to come. And so they've got nothing else to do, and we know that you got to go away from your farm, your ranch, or your business to show up to these meetings. But believe me, it will pay dividends down the road.
You used a good analogy where the coffee shop isn't just a small coffee shop anymore. It's the internet. It's you're not battling science anymore.
Yeah, and that's what really bothers me the most is if we're going to air our grievances, let's do it in person and not on the internet. But today, somebody doesn't like the way I did something or somebody else, and so what do? They go on the internet and they post it for tons of people to see. And if it just changes 2 or 3% mind of not to get actively engaged, then you are no longer a supporter of the industry, but you're actually subversive to the industry. And so people ought to think about their words and their actions. If you're not helping build a strong defense for our industry and what we do and how we do it, then you are subverting it and you're actually lending a hand to those that would like to see us put out of business.
Bottom line message here is support the groups, support the lobbyists, write those letters, do that. That's your message.
The message today is get engaged. Get engaged with your money, get engaged with your time, and serve on some of these different organizations where you can, but for sure show up when they ask you to show up and support them financially.
You're headed out of here, taking off. You mentioned you're going to be meeting with some bee guys.
Yeah, we're going to go back. AFBF is hosting the National Pollinator Meeting in Washington, D.C. So I've been asked to go back. We've done a lot of work with trying to get pollinators to get out of the valleys and into the hills. But unfortunately, a lot of our parklands don't want bees there because they're worried about the exposure to bees, to hikers, and other things. So again, it's just one of those things. Let's get work hand in hand to make sure some of our conservation areas, our parks, and other things can allow bees in there, so that will help grow bee health and get them out of the valleys and where we're doing intensive farming.
Let's talk about the fires a little bit. Fires in California, we don't know what the destruction is up there yet.
Yeah.
We think we have an idea, but it's going to take them getting in there. We have any idea what kind of losses we're looking at agriculturally or anything like that?
Not yet. We've even reached out some of our folks in the county farm bureaus. Everybody's still trying to assess and to make sure they can get these fires under control first before we start assessing the damages. We know it's just going to be huge, but up until this point, we're just over a week. And so we're just 8 days since this whole thing started, a week from when we woke up last Monday morning to see just what had happened in these areas, Napa, Sonoma, and spreading from there. And so there's going to be time for the assessments. In agriculture, people pull together when people are in need. We're a resilient group of people. And so I don't worry so much about agriculture. I worry about a lot of those people that are in those subdivisions. A lot of people that haven't been located yet that will probably be fatalities. And so just a devastating thing. But unfortunately, we need to make sure and fight back now and let people know, okay, climate change or not climate change in the dialogue, there should have been defensible space put in places that wasn't. And a lot of times it's government that's hindering our ability and the environmental groups that are hindering our ability to really put in defensible space. That has to stop.
Last thing here, you have your last conference coming up. You're going to be retiring after that.
Yep.
Is that correct? So talk about the conference a little bit and what's going on.
Well, the 3rd through the 6th of December is our 99th California Farm Bureau annual meeting. And so it's going to be down in Garden Grove. So we're looking forward to having a lot of folks there as we welcome in the new leadership. Jamie Johansson should be taking over as the next president. We're excited about that. First generation farmer, doesn't olive oil, very passionate about agriculture, very well spoken. And so he's going to be a great leader for our organization, which will then hopefully help lead this industry. And so he will help work with others like CAPCA and others and Western Growers and other organizations to really broaden our reach and to get out there and fight for agriculture. So we're looking forward to that annual meeting, and anybody that wants something to do the 3rd to the 6th of December, come on down to Garden Grove and have a good time at our annual meeting.
And you guys have a new building being made.
We're going to be building a new building, California Farm Bureau. We're entering into an agreement to sell our building so we can build a newer building, much more efficient building. And so we're looking forward to that. We're going to be just about 400 feet from our existing building on a lot that we have, but it's going to be with the new technologies, allowing for more teleconferencing and things like that, as well as just the efficiencies of building. It was the right thing to do. We had somebody that wanted our building, so it was the right time to make that move, and we're looking forward to that.
Once again, Taylor Hillman talking with Paul Winger. We'll have more from the CAPCA meeting and convention right after this. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West, and we'll be back in just a moment.
When it comes to a healthy bottom line for your farming operation, nothing helps like healthy soil. Producers who use soil health management systems report lower input costs while maintaining or even improving their yields. Plus, those systems help with drought protection and soil and water conservation. Contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office today to find out more and unlock the secrets in your soil. This message brought to you by the NRCS and this radio station.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our technical skills.
Our math. Our engineering skills.
You're going to need our help with your water. Your air. Your food.
You're going to need our organizational skills. Our problem-solving skills.
You're going to need our determination. Our honesty, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise, we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Your Beef Checkoff does all kinds of things to help make sure consumers feel good about buying beef. Like researching the health benefits of beef and sharing this news with healthcare professionals, or discovering new lean cuts of beef like the Denver cut steak, which fits an active lifestyle, or sharing the good news about these new beef products and cuts with chefs, grocers, and consumers. Get to know your checkoff and start sharing your views at mybeefcheckoff.com. Paid for by the Beef Checkoff.
Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by Agnet West. We go back to Taylor Hillman now at the CAPCA meeting in Reno.
Lane Wade, Technical Service Manager for Arista Life Science.
So we were talking a little bit here at CAPCA on the show floor. You talked about PHD, which is one of your guys' fungicide products. Heavy usage this year with the extra water and rain that we saw this year. Talk about the product, what it does, and how you saw a bigger need for it this year.
This is a fungicide that is a derivative. The active ingredient is a derivative from a Streptomyces bacterial species, actually. So it's not a typical pesticide in terms of being a derivative of the petroleum industry, for example. And it's a bio, as such, it was registered through the biological program of the EPA, so it's extremely favorable in terms of toxicity on non-target organisms. It had a big year this year in grapes and on tree crops because it is a fungicide that is chitin inhibiting. So there's very few, in fact, there's only one other fungicide in this with the same active ingredient. So the FRAC group, which is the Fungicide Resistance Action Committee numbers that separate out all the different fungicides, there's only one other one that's in this particular FRAC group. So it's got a very strong fit in terms of efficacy because it's chitin inhibiting and fungi, and that it's a rotational material that's excellent for resistance management.
We also talked about another product that could be seen in California come January. Talk a little bit about that product, what it does, and this will be the first time in a while that California's had something like this available, right?
Yeah, this is an antibiotic that has utility for plant bacterial disease infections, and it prevents those by it's an aminoglycoside, which is similar to oxytetracycline and streptomycin, which are already registered. But streptomycin was registered in the 50s, oxytetracycline was in the 70s, and we haven't had an antibiotic like this since that time. And this has the potential of being registered in California because it has no medicinal uses, no animal or human uses for any case, so there's no real issues of resistance or anything like that for animal bacterial issues. So this was registered in 2014 for palm fruit fire blight and federally. So the EPA granted this registration in September of 2014, and we've had it commercially for 2 years across the country in most states, with the exception of California until now. And I think California has got all the ecotoxicology that they need, all the data answered, and we're hoping to have a favorable decision in January of 2018 from them. So hopefully this coming year will be the first year it's registered in California. And that should, if everything goes well, not to jinx it, but if everything goes well, we'll have it on palm fruit, cherries, and walnuts.
Yeah, I was going to say, so this is something that walnut growers, especially all the walnut growers on the north end of the state that deal with added moisture and stuff with bacteria, can use this hopefully as a new tool.
Yeah, in the North State, walnut blight is a big problem that kind of gets overlooked because there's really only a couple of forms of materials registered for it, copper and manzanite or EBDC fungicide or combination of those things. And so this would be one of the only new conventional type of activity materials registered in years and years and years for walnuts. And for sure this past year there are walnut growers who had 30-40% infection rates. I mean, it was tremendous. Some varieties that normally won't get it, we'll see it in a year like last year when we have the excessive rainfalls. So it's a big deal in the North State. It might have a play in the South State even, because there was even some walnut blight below Sacramento and below Modesto. The other utility that it will have in California is for Pseudomonas diseases on cherries, which can cause either bacterial blast or bacterial canker. So this will be one of the only things registered for that particular organism, pretty much except for copper. And copper has resistance to that widespread through California. So it'll be one of the only materials actually with utility on cherries.
So fingers crossed. Thanks, Lane. Appreciate the time. Have a good show.
For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. You can also find us on Twitter at agnetwest or myself at Sabrina W. Hill. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.